It's 8 o'clock. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome to the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. John L. from the Johns Creek. No relation? Okay. From the Johns Creek group. He's come down about 21 years of sobriety. I saw him last year at the Friendship Group Sunday night speaker meeting at the Fusion Church. Just about the same, man. You're a very consistent alcoholic. He has good training, and he has a hell of a good story. So please welcome John to the podium.
My name is John Lenz, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Thanks, Tim. It's really a pleasure to be here tonight. I always like doing this a lot better after I've done it. So hopefully you'll bear with me as I get through this. My sobriety date is June 1st, 1983. And my home group is the Johns Creek group. And I have a sponsor. His name is John H. He's been my sponsor a little over 28 years. And I think it's important to start with that because I always need to remember where I came from, that I wasn't always where I am today. And there was a day when I couldn't see not drinking that day. It just wasn't going to be possible. I was going to drink every day. And I had nowhere to be home. I had reached the point where I had pushed everybody that cared about me away. And the idea that anybody would want me around was sort of ludicrous. And so having a home group where I can walk in and feel at home and have people around me that care about how I'm doing and can pick off whenever I'm not doing great because they know me. No one ever really knew me before I got here. That's a big deal. And then the fact that I have a sponsor is really the foundation of who I am today. I still talk to my sponsor just about every day. And I do it for a lot of reasons. Because we become great friends. Because he has tremendous wisdom. And I have a blind spot the size of a bus. And he can pick that off really quick when I start running down a path I shouldn't be running down. For me, a sponsor, what I was taught was a sponsor is his responsibility is to teach you how to do the steps. And what I found is that sponsors do steps with their sponsees like they had steps done with them. And I had a couple of great sponsors over the years. Bill R. was my sponsor for a year when I moved back to Atlanta from California, and then John became my sponsor thereafter. Both have had over 55 years of sobriety, and they trace their lineage back both to Dr. Bob and Bill W. And when I think about sponsorship and I think about how it works in this program, where someone that has been there before me can teach me how to live, it's a big deal. And every one of the people in this room that have a sponsor has that trace of lineage all the way back to the founders of this program because that's how this program works. It's one alcoholic helping another. That's our primary purpose. And if I don't remember that, then I get off track. This isn't something that just kind of happens, by osmosis. This program is something that sometimes requires an awful lot of work and an awful lot of help. And I was never really willing to allow people to help me when I first got here. I had to learn that it made a real difference in my life for me to do that. Whenever I get up behind these microphones, I have this fear that I'm going to run out of things to say. And so sometimes I don't get sober quick enough. So, if I don't get sober soon, just start throwing stuff at me. It'll probably wake me up because I've heard this before, so I tend to nap through it. But at the end of the day, what my job is to share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And, when I talk about fear, that's something that has been a part of my life just about since I can remember. It was always something that caused me to be afraid, caused me to think that I wasn't good enough or that I wasn't going to get what I wanted. I go all the way back to first grade. We were running a race out in the parking lot in the elementary school. And I came in second. And everybody clustered around the guy who came in first. And I said, I don't like the way this feels. So I'm not going to allow myself to feel this way anymore. So if there were times when I didn't think I could win or I couldn't be successful, then I quit early. Because it was a lot easier to say, I didn't want to do it anyway. Didn't really want to do that anyway. And I guess I was probably in fifth or sixth grade. A friend of the family, she was a good friend of my mother. She said, I don't understand you. You quit at everything you do. And it was true. It hurt me terribly. But the reality was that I did quit a lot of things. Because I wasn't going to come in second. And if I didn't really try, I couldn't really fail, right? So I was born in 1958. I'll be 56 in December. So that means I got sober when I was 24 years old. And there weren't very many young people in AA in the area where I got sober. So I just had to go to a lot of meetings. It didn't matter that I didn't always relate to who they were and what their life was like, but I could always relate to how they felt and what alcohol did to them. And I need to tell you that this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have a singleness of purpose, but I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so if I say alcohol, you can pretty well guarantee there was other stuff along with that. A lot of it. When I first got sober, I thought, I might be able to continue to do some other things. It took me 3 days, and they said, no, that's not happening. Because, I just want to change the way I feel. The big book, originally, they thought that it might be called The Way Out. That was one of the working titles of the big book. And that's what I always wanted. I wanted a way out. I didn't want to have a situation where I was forced to do anything that I didn't want to do. I wanted that way out. And that manifested itself for me in a lot of ways. I was adopted when I was 5 weeks old. And one advantage of that is that I knew my parents wanted me because they went out and got me. I can tell you for sure I took full advantage of that. I was almost loved to death because my parents wanted to please me. And I could scam and shoot the angles and pretty much usually got what I wanted. I kind of tend to think let me put it this way. It's my belief that alcoholism is a disease. And I believe that I had it when I was born. And I don't believe that if I'd had a different upbringing, that it would have been any different. There might have been different things that happened in my life, but I'm pretty sure I would have been standing up here regardless of whether or not my natural parents kept me or not. I kind of tend to think, too, that I was probably, I probably had a couple of drunks for parents, natural parents, because, you know, I was conceived, right, and given away. So something was going on there. They probably got conceived in the back of a truck or a or a car or something. But having that start meant that, you know, I had a lot of advantages. The thing was, though, that as I was growing up, I never felt like I connected with the people around me. I always felt like there was something missing. One of my first meetings in AA, someone said, yeah, I felt like I had a chapter missing out of my book. And I got that right away. I understood that very well. And so I never really could connect very well. I think alcoholics in general have a hard time with relationships, regardless of the kind of relationship. And that was certainly true for me. And as I went through my life, what I discovered was is that I could tell a lie and get away with it. I learned how to live a lie. That's the best way to be successful as a liar, is you learn to live it. And interestingly enough, it was probably 6 months after I got sober, I had to stop myself when I was talking to a friend of mine at a coffee shop. I said, I just lied to you. Because I had convinced myself so much that it was this way so that I could live with myself that I believed it. That's just kind of how it was. And I wanted to be convincing because I didn't ever want to get caught. And I was always doing stuff that I could get caught at. Now, that didn't mean I didn't get caught. You know, when I was in elementary school, I was writing do not a million times on the board. And when I moved a little bit older, that's when I got better at lying. But I was always looking for that way out. And I'm going to talk about something that, you know, part of my story has sort of little places where I decided to check out. There were times when I've decided to check out in my life. And I'm going to talk about those things because a lot of times alcoholics, you know, they figure, well, I can't drink now, but I'm going to leave that last option. If things get too tough, then I can just kill myself. And I'm here to tell you, you don't have to do that. And I'll tell you why as I go along that I learned that I don't have to do that. My path narrowed. And, you know, I discovered that suicide was a permanent solution to a temporary problem. But when I was in third grade, my parents sent me over to Alabama and had me staying with some friends that my dad had who had kids my age. And I was homesick and I wasn't sleeping at night and I was just miserable. And we were going through the woods one day and I look over the side of this cliff that we were walking along and there was a bunch of rocks down there. And I thought, you know, I could just dive off of this head first. I wouldn't have to feel like this anymore. That's how bad I wanted out sometimes. So is it any wonder that when I found alcohol, they could change the way I felt, that I didn't latch onto that with both hands? Of course not. I mean, that was just savior for me as I moved into my teens. So every time I turned around, there was something going on that I didn't like. And so I tried to fit my life so that I could make it because I felt that unmanageability, right? Before I even took my first drink, I felt that unmanageability in my life. Things were sort of carrying me away and I just didn't have that control. And I wanted that control. That's why I lied a lot. When I was in seventh grade, I was playing sports. I played sports in every season, in its season. So baseball, football, basketball, and so forth. And in the summer of my seventh grade, I left a state swim meet and went and won the championship with my team. I didn't win it, but my team did. Of course, if you had listened to me back then, I won the championship. And, you know, I thought everything was going okay. You know, things were working out. I batted a 492 that season. My dad loved the fact that I played baseball. And then I went into high school. Back then they didn't have middle school. And started playing football. Came up lame. I had a condition where my bones grew apart in my foot and I couldn't run. And the friends that I grew up with were merciless. They wouldn't give me any break. You know, I couldn't run. It hurt. I wasn't going to play hurt. That's something else I never did. I never played hurt. Although, if you know me today, there's been a lot of times since I got sober that I've done that. But the reality was is that I just wasn't going to do that. And so I took a lot of crap. And then when the year came around and it was time to play football again, I went and started practicing the two-a-days. And I was so out of shape, and they were just beating me to death. And finally I just said, you know, I'm not going to do this. And so I quit. And from that moment on, there was kind of a path for me because I was ostracized by the people that I knew. I wasn't that close with them because I never would allow them to get close. But it was really clear that they just didn't want to hang around with me anymore. And so I started looking for other people to hang around with. Now, in my school, we had the vestiges of the hippies. They were called freaks. We had the jocks, and we had the, they called them nerds, the brainy people. And so I moved from the jocks over to the freaks, and I started talking to these people. And they started telling me about what they were doing on the weekends. And it sounded pretty good. It sounded like a lot of fun. So one weekend, I went out to Stone Mountain and got stoned. That was my first experience. Within about a month, I was bringing peanut butter jars full of bourbon to school. And it was on. And anything that I could get my hands on that would change the way I felt, I would do. In school or out, didn't matter. And I learned that I could go to work, so I could pay for all this stuff. And I also learned that if I sort of lengthened my work hours, then I could stay out a lot longer and just party. And so that's what ended up happening. By the time I was 15, I was doing something every day. I was getting loaded every day. I qualified for this program at that time. I really believe that. I was ready then, but I didn't know it. I was very proud of the fact that I was extreme. I was flat out all the time. And that could get me in trouble. You know, I just paid attention a little bit in school, and I kind of got by. I never got any very good grades. But things started happening. Like, for example, we were out, supposed to be at the library, and we were driving down the road drinking beer. I was driving. My friend was in the seat next to me, and there were three guys in the back. We were all drinking. And nailing mailboxes with beer bottles. So if you ever had a mailbox nailed by a beer bottle, I'm sorry. we did a lot of that. And he missed one. It got him upset. So he kind of sits out of the window, and he says, I'm going to get this next one. And he did. I heard him yell, got it. And then the next thing you know, he's back in the car. What we didn't notice when we were driving along was that it was the mailbox, and then 2 feet past that, right on the edge of the curb, was a telephone pole. And he hit the telephone pole with his head. And it virtually scalped him. And I turned over. He spilled my beer, so I was yelling at him for spilling my beer. And then I noticed the sheen on his head. And we, I drove like a maniac to the emergency room. Got him in there, went into the front door screaming for help. And it turned out that he was okay. It literally scalped him. And here's how, I don't know about you as an alcoholic, but I'm going to figure out a way to avoid getting in trouble. So we're sitting there while he's bleeding, trying to brainwash him into telling them a story that didn't happen. Oh, you fell playing Frisbee, remember? Yeah. He couldn't get it. I don't know. He just couldn't get it. So we got in a lot of trouble for that. So those are the kinds of things that were going on in my life. And, you know, Norman in Texas talks about seconds and inches. You know, that's the way alcoholism is when I'm in the middle of it. With a split second, everything can change. If I drank today, I believe that I'll be worse than I was when I started, than I quit. And anything can happen. There were a lot of days where when I started drinking, it wasn't a big deal. But there were other times when it became a big deal. And, you know, if there had been a split second or a fraction of an inch closer to that telephone pole, you know, he wouldn't be here today. And I probably wouldn't either. I'd probably be in jail or something. You know, I sure wouldn't be living the life I'm living. So that's the way alcoholism is for me. That's the way this disease is. It drives me to places I never planned to be. I think I'm going to be okay. It'll work out. And a lot of times when I was drinking, you know, things would get bad, so I'd sort of back off, get the heat off a little bit, never stop completely. But then, you know, as soon as the heat came off, I'd be back right at it again. I never really wanted not to drink. It was just something that I did. I ended up going to the University of Georgia. I went for one thing, ended up doing something else. Basically, what I did is I drank. And I had a girlfriend that became my fiance, and it made her life a nightmare. I found myself in an interesting situation. I'd go to class, and I always had good intentions. You know, I'm going to really buckle down and study. And for the first 2 or 3 weeks, I did. It didn't stop me from still getting loaded, but I didn't really blow the doors off for the first 3 weeks or so. And then someone would say, let's go out tonight. And I wouldn't do my homework. And I'd stay out until 3 in the morning. And I wouldn't get up and go to school the next day. And the next thing I knew, 2 weeks had passed. I hadn't been to class. That happened to me all the time. I withdrew from 23 classes from the University of Georgia on a medical withdrawal. So I didn't have an incomplete. I didn't have an F. I scammed my way through. My file at the infirmary was about this thick because I learned that if I started early, I could get the process down so that when 2 weeks before the end of the quarter, I could withdraw on a medical withdrawal and be okay. Now, I was okay with that. My parents weren't real happy about that. And the school wasn't really happy about that. But the reality was I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I needed to drink more than I needed to go to school. And eventually, my performance became very clear that I wasn't going to be able to do it. So I came up with this idea that, well, we were going to get married, so I'm going to quit school and go to work. And that will give me the ability to get some money so that we can get married. That's what I told the world. The reality was that I just wasn't hacking it, and I wanted to drink more than I wanted to go to school. That was the bottom line. And that's usually, if there was a choice to be made, alcohol won every time, every single time. So I quit, got a job in a restaurant, and within 6 months I was questioning the marriage and questioning this and questioning that. And so eventually I engineered a separation because I saw what I was doing in that relationship. The nightmare I was putting that woman through was just beyond belief. Yeah, I didn't beat on her, but I was verbally abusive sometimes. I had rage that was inexplicable. I'd hit stuff, walls usually. Interestingly enough, you know, every place I've ever lived before I quit drinking had a hole in the wall. Every place. Every place that I've lived since I quit drinking hasn't had a hole in the wall. Except for one my son put in. So maybe he's following in my footsteps a little bit. But, you know, that rage was lifted from me. And I found that that rage was always due to fear. I was always afraid something wasn't going to work out my way. And, you know, 2 days after we split apart that marriage, and I called it off the day before the invitations were going to be printed. I waited all the way up to the last minute. And 2 days after that, I said, oh, shit, I made a big mistake. And I knew that I had passed the point of no return. There was no way I was going to be able to get her back. And so at that point, I just couldn't live with myself anymore. And I ate a bottle of phenobarbital and drank a half a gallon of scotch and lay down to die. I wanted to die. I was going to check out. I didn't want to do this anymore. And when I woke up, I said, well, I guess I didn't do that right either. You know, that was kind of my refrain. I guess I didn't do that right either because things weren't working out. When I drank a lot, things didn't work out very good. So a few days later, I decided I was really going to do it. So I got some syringes. My father was a diabetic. And I shot air into every vein I could find. In my arms, my legs, my hands. And I lay down to die. And I was staying with my parents at the time. And I was working. But I didn't set the alarm because I wasn't going to be getting up. And the next thing I know, someone was knocking on my door saying, aren't you going to go to work today? So I got up and went to work. And for the next couple of weeks, I walked around thinking I was going to keel over, but I didn't. Well, you know, it didn't stop me from drinking like I was drinking, but it made me think, well, maybe there's a reason for me to be here. I ended up getting fired from that job. That was the lie that I was telling myself. I really wanted to leave that job. It wasn't a good job. I'm going to just go find something else to do. But the reality was I got fired. And I got fired for the same reason I'd fired another guy 2 weeks before, because he wasn't showing up. And he was a drunk, too. And so then I got recruited to go to California. And about time to get sober. I got recruited to go to California as a photographer. I had no qualifications for that. My next-door neighbor knew someone that had those jobs. They took me to Tennessee, trained me for 3 weeks. Sent me out to California to be a photographer. I was going to go out and do church directories. So if you can imagine a raging drunk, drinking all night, staggering in the next morning, taking pictures of 300 people in a church, that's what I was doing. It was pretty crazy. When we got out there, they gave us a free apartment. They put us up in a hotel because our apartment wasn't ready originally. Ran up a bar bill of $1,000 in that 3 days. They paid it. I thought, I'm living now. This is great. California. All right. Start over. You know, I'm always looking to start over. Always looking for that new start. Or it'll be different this time. The problem was, I continued to drink, and I brought me with me. And nothing changed. Before long, I was in trouble again. You know, I opened my eyes one day, one night, 3 o'clock in the morning, and missed a VW bug with a family of four in it by inches. I was doing 55, they were doing 35. We were on a narrow two-lane road. If I'd hit them, I would have gone right through them. That shook me, but it didn't stop me from drinking. Consequences generally didn't stop me from drinking. It led me to do things to get the heat off, but it didn't stop me from drinking because that's how I lived. There had been a period of time when I was in college when I tried to stop drinking a little bit. I don't know how hard I tried, but I tried. And eventually I just realized, you know, I'm going to drink until I die. And I thought maybe that wasn't going to be too long anyway. So things were kind of continuing to snowball. My life was going downhill again. I just couldn't not drink. I'd wake up in the morning in so much pain, my back was hurting, and you know, but I knew that if I took a couple of drinks, it wouldn't hurt anymore. So I got to the point where I was on my way on a Memorial Day weekend to a job, and I just couldn't do it. The fear was just, it had hold of me. And I called back to Tennessee and told them, hey, my car's broken down. And I was already stoned and drunk by this time. I don't know, 7:30 in the morning. I'd driven part of the night. And they asked me where I was. And I told them. And they said, well, we'll come pick you up. Problem was, I was 100 miles away from where I told him I was. And that freaked me out. I said, oops, you know, here we go. Well, get this. I decided to plead insanity. I figured that if they're going to come look for me, I'm going to disappear. I'm going to go up to Northern California. And I'm going to catch a bus and go down to Southern California and leave my car up north and plead insanity. You know, that's how we are sometimes. That's how I was anyway. You know, if it was a scam that was going to get me out of trouble, I didn't care how bad it was going to be as long as I got out of trouble and got my way. So they didn't come get me. They told me they needed proof of the, you know, the car, but that wasn't a hard thing. So I drove back to Fresno where I was living, and I started drinking the clock around. I drink, and I pass out, and I wake up, I drink, I pass out, and I wake up, I drink. And during one of the times when I woke up, there was a commercial on TV for a treatment center 90 miles away. And I called them, just out of the blue. And they said, well, if you don't want to come here, there's one right in your town, so why don't you call them? I gave them my phone number. They gave me their phone number. And I called them. And it was the day before Memorial Day. I said, well, we can't take you today. You can come in on Tuesday. And I said, oh, great. Another party. So I figured I'd hit it hard for the next two nights and go in on Tuesday morning. And I didn't do that. I called him up on Tuesday morning and said, I need to do a few things before I come in. And I did. But on Wednesday morning, I went in. And I sat down in that day room, and I looked up on the wall, and these steps were on the wall. And I saw God everywhere. And I said, I can't do this. This is just too much for me. Now, here's someone that's about to die, really. I was sick, and I was in a lot of trouble. And I just wasn't going to be able to go much longer. But I just wasn't willing. And then I saw those little words, those four words that are underlined in italics, as we understood them. I said, well, you know, what I'm doing right now isn't working. I'm going to try it. Now, I believe very strongly in the steps. They changed who I am. They gave me a new life. And I think they're the heart of this recovery program. That's where I find my recovery. But I also believe you need to work them in order with a sponsor. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth. When I do that, that's when I begin to find that spiritual connection. I also believe that it's a little dangerous to have too much knowledge. I saw the thing about the fearless and moral inventory. So when the nurse brought me in to take what they call the psychosocial, my history, I dumped every deepest, darkest secret on her I could think of. It blew, you know, I saw her eyes widen a couple of times. So I'm never running for office because it's all written down there in Fresno, California. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, the way politics are these days, they'll get a hold of it. So, but the reality was that that was a demonstration of my willingness to do whatever it took. And that's something that somebody told me almost immediately, is that if you want to stop drinking and you want to have a better life, then you need to find a willingness to do whatever it takes. You got to put sobriety number one. And so I went through this 30-day program, and I did the steps the way they wanted me to. Although they weren't thorough, I knew I was going to have to do them again. And I went to a halfway house because they told me to. And I quit working at the job that I was in because I didn't think I could stay sober. I didn't realize when I quit that job that it was going to be another 2 years before I really worked again. I had a little odd jobs here and there. But for the most part, I lived on unemployment, $400 a month for 2 years. And I got kicked out of the halfway house. I got 13th step. If you don't know what a 13th step is, ask your sponsor. I had a blast. The problem was is that I wasn't focusing on me. And I was getting in trouble in sobriety because I wasn't looking at what was important. I wasn't focusing on working the steps. And so I got sober in June, along about November. I had become the secretary of a 10 o'clock candlelight meeting on Friday night. And I was responsible for setting up the meeting. Now, along the way, I had become a vacuum cleaner salesman. So just think about this. This brand new alcoholic, newly sober, with all my nerve endings raw, going door to door asking people to buy $400 vacuum cleaners. Didn't go over very well. A lot of doors slammed in my face, a lot of rejection. I was a sensitive guy. It was very hard for me. I wasn't very successful at it. When I don't enjoy what I'm doing, I don't want to do it. And usually I don't do it. I've learned how to do those things in sobriety, though. But the reality was that I couldn't do it. My boss told me that he didn't think I could make it out in the field. But he saw a lot of potential in me. He knew my story. So he offered me this job to repair vacuum cleaners. And, you know, it was really a nice thing of him. And it was great. He was offering me a salary. I didn't have a salary before. But that's not what I heard. I heard, you're never going to amount to anything. You failed, and you're going to repair vacuum cleaners for the rest of your life. Because that's the way we are sometimes. My perceptual engine is broken. Whatever's going on in my life, it feels like it's going to be like this for the rest of my life. And it's not true. It's my disease lying to me. So I made the decision that I had two choices. I could either shoot myself or repair vacuum cleaners for the rest of my life. Those were the choices that my disease gave me. They put me in that corner and said, choose. And I chose to shoot myself. But I had that meeting to set up. And it occurred to me that maybe someone out there might need a meeting, so I better go set that meeting up. And I got over there, and I set it up, and no one showed up because everybody was in L.A. for a conference. And this woman showed up right before the meeting. I'd asked her to lead it, and no one else showed up. So I figured I'm going to shut this thing down, go home, and shoot myself. And so what did she do? She said, you know, whenever two or more are gathered, and she started the meeting. And a couple of minutes later, some more people showed up, and I got honest during that meeting. Now, I bet there's some people in here that might have kind of understood what I was talking about, that choice of killing myself for vacuum cleaners, you know? The insanity that we have in our disease can be amazing. But when we're in it, it's so hard to overcome it. And that's why I found going to meetings a lot and talking to my sponsor a lot and working with other people a lot is the best defense against that crazy stuff. Because my disease is out to get me. How many people here are under 30 days of sobriety? That's awesome, man. Here's what I would say. It's a bigger deal that you guys have under 30 days of sobriety, then it's a big deal than I have 31 years. It's a bigger deal. It's a lot harder to have 25, 26 days of sobriety in a lot of ways because it's fresh. That twist in the gut that says I got to have it, it's so hard to overcome. Being here is a big deal. And what I discovered when I got here was that there's a whole lot of ways that I can address and take care of that twist in my gut that says I got to drink. I got to do this. What I discovered was that when I'm in a meeting, I'm not drinking. So I went to a lot of meetings early on. But I didn't have a great time. I lost everything I owned. I had mice running across my chest at night because I was sleeping on the floor this guy went through treatment with, which incidentally, I had nowhere else to go. And when he, you know, basically, the night of my choice whether or not I was going to kill myself, he started shooting dope and drinking again. So I'm living with this maniac. And, you know, my path got narrower. I no longer, and to this day, I have not looked at suicide as an option, as a true option. So if anybody's thinking that that's a way out, you know, I would have really sold myself short. I've had an amazing life. Eventually, I got a job. A job that somebody gave me and allowed me to muddle through until I learned how to work again. Eventually, I got good at what I was doing. People sought me out. Now, I'm living on $400 a month and having mice running across my chest when I first got sober. And eventually, I ended up running a company and owning a company. And the financial things came to me. It didn't mean I got to keep them, though. You know, the big book says that whatever's going on in our lives, and I'm paraphrasing this, that whenever we have problems, we have challenges, we invariably find that if we look back, we see that it's something that we've done to put us in that position. So drinking when I shouldn't drink, stealing when I shouldn't steal, lying when I shouldn't lie, it usually brought me to a point where I got in trouble. And I'm a risk taker, so I took risk with my business. Just know that if you have a situation and you own a business and it looks like you got some great things, but that, you know, people aren't paying you, you know, don't go take out your 401k and hope to pay it back when they pay you. That results in your owing the IRS over $200,000. And when everything goes to heck, you can't pay them. Then they're not happy. Those are the kinds of things that can happen in anybody's life. It happened in mine. What I've discovered is that I can go through anything. And I've lived week to week, day to day in sobriety. I've lost people that I love. I've had health issues. And I've discovered that no matter what, I can stay sober through all of that. And that's really something that I never would have believed if you had told me that when I first got sober. I have a couple of kids that have never seen me drink. And, you know, they may go through this too because, you know, they got a double whammy. Their mother, I met a girl in AA and we got married. And so both parents are alcoholic. So they, you know, they may have a challenge. But here's the deal. Service work saved my life. Literally saved my life. If I hadn't had that meeting to go to, I would have shot myself that night. Service work keeps this thing going, this whole thing going. And service work is as simple as sitting next to someone that's got 3 days when you got a week and saying, I know what it's like. I've been there. This is what is going on with me today, and you can get through this because I did. Service work is making sure that there's coffee made like Tim is doing in the back when everybody's getting ready for the meeting. Service work is setting up the chairs and reaching out your hand to say hello to someone that's new. Those are the kinds of things that make sure that this program's here so that if my kids ever need it, it'll be here. I have a debt I can never repay. And I'm eternally grateful that I've been given this gift. And I believe that everybody in this room, because you're sitting in this room, has been given a gift. You know, it's up to us whether or not we take advantage of it or squander it. But this helps me stay sober. I thank you for helping me in my sobriety. Thank you very much.
John, thank you for the gift of service that you gave us tonight. Definitely helped my sobriety. How about you guys? Another round of applause. Chet, we have the chips right here for you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chet Gregory, and I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. Down in the South, they have a chip system. I'm a Yankee. I'm Mount Pisgah's token Yankee, so... this is the most important chip. Anybody would like to try our way of life? Giving up the booze? All right.
Just another home. child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't stress shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its day and the lessons fall of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.